said a few weeks ago, he listened to me, and he didn't change it. And that's how it got to be the Riviera.
I read somewhere where you told about being in London and seeing the Rolls Royce.
Yeah. Well, I said, saw a Rolls Royce out the street, and I thought if you just lowered it, that those crisp lines would look good. And then I said, if you put the fender, back fender, kicked up, Gordon didn't want that, he wanted to go through, and I said, well, I have to kick up, so it was a cross between a Ferrari and a Rolls.
Where was that?
See, that was the event.
And Dave's asking if you would tell us why you were in London, what event was happening at that time?
The automobile show. That's the time that they said to Seville, they said that I copied Mercedes and Serona. I said, my dad said, you want to steal or rob a bank, not a grocery store, I copied Rolls Royce. And when I was up at Rolls, they took me up in their office and showed how they put that in a stockholder's report.
That's a big story. Do you think every car should, well, that's a silly question. I was reading some things that you had been saying. You were talking about modern design, your feelings about modern design, feelings about taking designs from nature. That I don't know whether this is going to ring a bell with you, but would you just give us a little bit of your philosophy about design versus modern design in general, other kinds of designs that are around?
Well, I think design has to have a basis. And some of this extreme modern design, which is just like throwing egg on a plate, I can't stand it. And I think, for instance, Marion had me out to Meadowbrook one night, and I saw the ballet. And I said, now that's beautiful music, but it isn't loud. It's graceful. Where some of these cars that you're doing today that are just flying, bump, bump, it's like jazz music. It's no symmetry, no beautiful flow to it. And I think a car, you ought to do have something when you design a car. You ought to be able to look at it all day long and find something different, and not just some smash egg on a plate.
Looks like you took some inspiration from Shark.
Yes, now they're saying a grouper, or a Jewfish we call it, just look like this. But a shark, watching it in the water, they're excitable, and they're interesting. That's why I got inspiration from the shark. It's exciting. It's got some action.
How did the design of the stingray come about?
Well, I wanted something different there. I didn't want to, you know, all the guys were drawing cars from books out of Europe, Ferraris, Jaguars. They're all tubes that were just no excitable lines, and I wanted to get something with some action.
Exotic offshoots of the Corvette. Could you go back a bit to the Corvette and to the original inspiration that Mr. Earl had?
Kurt LeMay, the Army bases, they had the government, or the people would give money for an activity for the pilots, sports car activity. And LeMay said to Earl, why don't you design an American? That's where Earl got the first idea. And we had it at the proving ground where the executives were out there one day, and he had it set up in a private room. he took it to New York and put it in the show. And once it got in the show, everybody, that's a way to sell a car. Because they say, why don't you build it for us?
Who were the staff designers and engineers on the original Corvette, please?
Duntov. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Mitchell, we're fascinated by the Harley Earl's first concept car, the Buick Y-Job. What are your remembrances of that?
Well, Harley wanted, that's when he started the first time. He wanted to do something of his own. And then it was set so if it rained, the windows would go up automatically. And it had the first automatic top and all that stuff. And then after that, he did the LeSabre.
Can you tell us about that?
The LeSabre was really, with that round nose, it's like a fighter plane. He was inspired by that. But Earl wanted things to look different. That's why he liked Ned Nichols. Ned drew that kind of stuff. Wild things. And when you think of it, actually, they did those too. They were unusual cars. Because we got in the habit later on of everything getting a foreign car, it had to look like it came out of Europe. Got it snuffed off nose, back end soft. That's why I did this thing right. It's sharp. Sharp, and it's a secret. You can't see it here, but I want to get exciting on it. Then this is the car I wanted to come out. That's the mid-engine job, but they never brought that up. I thought they'd bring that up some. I don't know if he's a great philosopher of design. The only thing that got me, I used to go to Indianapolis to get inspiration. And then they started to do these little Formula One cars that looked like a do-it-yourself kit. You know, this chopped on that one, there was no inspiration. It's hard to explain a design. You just like it or you don't. But that model I did for Earl there, the flowing line, when I say the car ought to look like it's going 180, sitting still. Just static, it ought to have flow line.
Did you have a name? Did you have a name for that particular model? Never named.
Yeah, we're getting a little noise. Why don't we stop now and then pick up a little bit more after the
other round. It was a 16 cylinder. raced against. See, what Hitler did, he gave Mercedes and Auto Union special money to beat out the Italians and the French and the other cars, the English. And this shows an Auto Union, the engine was in the back.
What other attributes did it have? What other characteristics did that particular
vehicle? Well, a 16-cylinder engine in the rear, but very few people could drive it. And Rosemeyer was a motorcycle rider, and they could handle it because they didn't have any bad things to get over in a Ringer car. And then he got killed in the Autobahn in a record run. And then New Valeri, the Italian who was a motorcycle rider, he came on to be the next driver. But I often wonder what it would be like to sit there in the front and have that big engine back of you.
You raced yourself several times, did you not?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about those experiences?
Oh, just at the sports car events, Corvettes. I drove that big job there with Augie Patch that took him around Elkhart Lincoln. Going down the hill, I missed the shift. I had the broadside, and they said over the speaker, look at Mitchell do a four-wheel drift. I just slid down the hill, and Augie was on the floor hanging on the instrument panel. And he said, God damn it, here I'm all my racing days, and I'm going to get killed by Mitchell. He was a nice guy.
And your reaction was? A grin as big as sin.
Yeah. And I drove that car there and showed me that I was cool enough to have a German Mercedes.
Later on, Mr. Mitchell would like to film some of the actual photographs, but one of the pair of photographs of your really early drawing and then your much later design could be one of the terrific things. Maybe when we start up again, you could describe what that is for us, so that we can add it in the picture as you're telling us about it later.
Did you fly in St. Augustine?
Jacksonville.
Jacksonville.
Yeah. What was Mr. Knudsen's strength as you saw him in the...
He was an engineer. Sloan didn't think much of him as a creative person.
Mm-hmm.
But he did one thing. He said he went from Ford. He said he couldn't make a car as cheap as Ford, but he'd make one better, and that's how he made the Chevrolet a better car.
You ever talk about the circumstances of leaving Ford back in the early 20s? Monkey was an interesting and nice person, wasn't he?
Yeah. He and I are the same age.
Are you really?
His birthday's in October, mine's July. We get together down here every time.
Do you?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Wonderful.
Went over to Seminole and had lunch there. He's got to watch it. He's got what is it when you got too much sugar? When you got to watch that, diabetes. And then his hearing is off. He can't hear one ear very well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sister was very nice. She took us in, and we talked almost the whole day about her father
Yeah.
and her brother.
Quiet guy.
because I didn't have any committees, I didn't have anybody push me around when you're an artist. When you have no committees, you're a nice person. When I got back to PM, I found the only way I could make sure design was good is when it was sold. I remember one time I was telling one of my cohorts that I had the running board on the Cadillac and I had the bumper on the Buick and this and that. And he said, when you see it on the street, then you know you had it. Because it could get washed off any time between the time you designed and the time it came out. So I found you had to sell. You had to come in and try to sell your own design. And I became a pretty cocky, outspoken guy from then on. And a lot of people said I was outspoken, but I didn't used to be that way. When you're an artist, you don't, but when you're a designer, you sell it past the salespeople and the engineers. You had to fight for what you wanted. And I became a little feisty.
You're also talking there about your ideas about how a lot of cars are sort of homogenized.
Yeah, I think they, Christensen, who was my business manager, used to say, we're getting homogenized. Each one's taken a good part of the other one, and pretty soon they all look alike. And I think that's what's important today. You're losing what used to make a Duesenberg, and what made a Patrick, what made a Cadillac, what made a Buick. So many of the cars today are all looking alike.
You've told us a hilarious anecdote about Harley Earl having a fender bender with an unsuspecting motorist and what happened when the motorist got out of the car and became
a... Earl was going around 8 Mile Road one night in the rain. Some guy sideswiped him. Earl pulled him over. So then this guy jumped out of his car and ran down, going to take a punch at Earl. And Earl slowly opened the door, and as he's 6'4", got up, the guy ran, jumped in his car, and beat him. Bill Earl told me that story. Because Earl was all in his, he was long legs and short upper body. He wasn't tall on the saddle. And he used to tell everybody, look at the headroom I've got here. Because he could pull down in the car.
Mr. Mitchell, what do you think somebody should have? What kind of qualities do you think somebody should have to be a good car designer?
Well, there's two things you got to do. You've got to know when to stick by your guns. And then you also got to know when to get off of a bad design. Earl had a great faculty for starting something, stop it, saying it's not going to work. A lot of people get stubborn and don't do that. On the other hand, there's times when you have to fight your design through, when people would say, it's not going to work. Not going to work, and you've got to believe it. But so you really got to be two kinds of people. You got to know when to get off the horse, and you got to know when to fight it on through.
Did you say you need to have gasoline in your blood?
Oh, definitely. I used to say I don't care where the guy went to school or how good he can draw, but if he hasn't got gasoline in his blood, I never drew a car that was standing still. They're always bouncing off the ground. Somebody said, look at those wheels, they're always cocked. I said, that makes it go. And you've got to have gasoline in your blood. And love, I used to say I could take a guy in a car and drive him around the block and he'd have a heart attack. Because you've got to be able to know how to drive a car. And I said, any car I had to have a very fast engine. Because pretty is pretty does. I don't give a damn how good it looks if it can't go like it looks. And that's why the Corvair didn't go off so good when it started out. It didn't have the power to back up the design. And you've got to have the power to go with the car to make it go.
But the Stingray was that kind of car.
Oh, yes. I had fuel injection in there that was something. And I changed it once and put in Webers, four Webers, and it never was as hot as it was with the fuel injection.
How did the fiberglass body on the Stingray come
Well, that's the reason sting fiberglass is good on Corvettes. And we got it in there. You could change a car. See, if it's a steel body, that's a big engineering job to change. But the reason we wanted to keep making them fiberglass, each kid could change his design and make it to suit his taste. And I remember I'd go up to Elkhart Lake, and they'd have all around that track bumper to bumper special Corvettes. And they'd ask me to be a judge, and I'd hate to be a judge because I'd hate to pick one car over the other. And these guys could make their car look the way they wanted. That's why we stayed the fiberglass.
What kind of advice would you give for young car designers, if people who want to become car designers?
Well, I think the best school is Art Center College in Los Angeles. And now the school in Detroit's getting better all the time, the School of Design. But I think they're the two best schools. Of course, okay. They've got to love cars.
Dave, go ahead.
Mr. Mitchell, you've been quoted as saying that a couple of your favorite creations was, of course, the 64 Corvette Stingray and the 1968 Corvette. Can you tell us a little about the Stingray and then the Mako Shark and the Manta Ray, the process?
Well, I did those cars to take to Europe for the shows, and the Manta Ray. I remember I took it over and showed it to Agnelli, who was head of Fiat, and he wanted us to get an automatic transmission for his Ferrari. And I put a show on it in Turin and drove it around the park there. And I got back to the hotel, they said you were on television, and I saw myself driving around. And what I did, I held my foot on the brake and one foot on the gas so I could go like hell and then lock it right up whenever I wanted. And I had pressure on both the brake and the clutch automatic, so I didn't need any heavy leg pressure.
Sure, let me ask you. Talk a little bit about the tech center and what kind of influence, what kind of impact that had on the company.
Well, I think the tech center changed all of our people. It's like leaving a small town going to New York City. When we moved out to the tech center, I watched everybody change. Our modelers were cleaned up, go to lunch, they made up better. And we walk around at lunchtime out in the park by the lake. And it was like a college fraternity, sorority house. And it brought about, overnight we got better designs. It upgraded all our things. See, we were on the, down in the Research Building B, right back of the General Motors building, before we moved out there. And Earl told us, he says, that was going to make a big difference in your life, and it did. Designs got better, people dressed better, they felt better. Environment is a very powerful thing.
It was a Saarinen creation. How did that come about?
I think Sloan got Earl, and Earl talked him in on one of his trips. He went with Sloan in the summer, those cruises. And Earl sold him on having that design center separate from the division so you could be on your own and do your own work. And then Sloan said, yeah, but you ought to bring Kettering in with you. And that's when you got Kettering to come in too. So you had the research editor design. And then they got the idea of putting a lake in there, and Curtis said that's cheaper than mowing the grass.
Could you give us a sort of a word picture of Harlow Curtis and his effect on GM design and automotive history?
Well, I liked him, of course. He got his start from Buick, and my dad was a Buick dealer. And I told Dad what a great thing it was to have him sit down on the bench and talk to me one-to-one, man-to-man, just when I was a young kid. And even after I got his designed Cadillac, he would always try to get me to buy a Buick. And he'd fix up every deal he could get to deliver me a Buick. And Earl didn't buy that sometimes, but he let him do it as often as he could.
Could you talk a little more about the Riviera? What you wanted the Riviera to be about Powell?
Well, I wanted the Riviera to, as a result of what Ford was doing, to bring out their new cars. We didn't have an answer because we just had the two-seater Corvette. And I wanted it to be a LaSalle. Cadillac didn't need it. And the answer is Buick, Olds, and Pontiac all tried to get it. And I had a design down in the room with Ned Nichols. Gordon had seen it, but nobody else. And I fought for what it ought to be, and I didn't want anybody to change the design. So George Elgis, who was head of Buick, agreed that not to fight me and to go along and keep it the way it was, and that's the way Buick got the design.
Could you describe what the Riviera, original Riviera design was like?
Well, the original, because I was going to call it LaSalle, it had two fine grills over the where the headlight would go, and then a sharp front end. And it was going to be called a Riviera, a LaSalle. We named it after the Riviera, which was the name of the first hardtop Buick.
Silver arrows. Can you describe those?
Well, there's one that I got. I think was not a very popular design. The second one I made, because I made it a fastback and a boat tail, and a boat tail is not good on a wide car. It's like a Corvette's an arrow, but. I had Chuck Jordan take it, change the backlight so it was smaller, and put an angle on it. And I liked it, but Gordon never did like it. And he didn't want it to be made, and I argued with him on it. Roach, I told Roach I wanted to have it go. It went on, but it was never popular.
What would you say is the biggest change you've seen in automotive design in the last 20 years?
Well, I think they're getting homogenized too much. I think they're losing their identity. You can't tell a Buick from an Oldsmobile, a Cadillac, and that's what we've got to get back to. And Sloan used to say, a car for each and every person's purpose. And that way you'd have a Chevrolet, a Pontiac, an Oldsmobile, a Buick, and a Cadillac. Well, then later on, everybody got a piece of everything. And like the Cadillac getting that little, what do you call it? The little V8. They don't need a car like that.
Palante?
No, the little one.
Cimarron?
Cimarron. But they got so many smeared up in between that you can't, like the big, one of the best buys, as Bumpy said, is the Caprice Cat, the Chevrolet, with the big engine, the big body. And I, in a way, I was to blame for getting Chevrolet up into that. And the way that happened, Bumpy was the head of Pontiac, and Cole was head of Chevrolet. And they never got the B body, they had the A body. They were always a year behind in the styling. So one year, they decided to get it. They wanted a bigger change. And they made a body, and I designed it, where you changed the upper and the lower, and changed the whole body to catch up to the B body. And my chief engineer showed me, he said, I want to show you something, how you could put Chevrolet on the same body as the B body. We hadn't taken it, and by changing the wheelbase and everything, you made a bigger Chevrolet, but you put it all on the same body. So I'll never forget this. Earl was in Haiti on a vacation, and I didn't want to take the responsibility of going after this, but I think about it, and I'll never forget. He was always a rough guy, but this time he said, "Hello, Bill, how are you?" And I said, "How you doing?" He said, "You know, I got a little card I got."
That's, and that really was the only...
As long as the red light is on, you're in business. Okay.
Okay.
Let's try it. Way back there.
Today is January 7th,
1987. Yes. Go ahead.
And we are in West Palm Beach, Florida.
At the William L. Bill Mitchell Studio.
Oh, no, you don't have
any.
Oh, sorry.
John and Kelly, right?
Yeah.
Great photograph.
So that's the... There you go. That's the...
No,
my guy down
at
the Kleenex guy.
Oh, it is.
You giving me a line of light
name there? And
I think it's through a light left suit.
Okay.
Oh, are they?
She's about 30.
Yeah.
He's over 9.
Okay. Excellent.
Kimberly. Kimberly, yes. All right.
Kimberly.
And his teenage wife.
Yeah.
They're going through a divorce, huh?
Yeah.
Down in Florida, I think.
Yeah.
No, actually, the image is quite good. It's quite youthful.
Oh, yeah,
turn that on.
The guy in his 80s.
And I
remember when he's in his 20s.
Right.
I'm 74. Turn the back light on.
The back?
Had no recurrences, no relapses since the surgery. Well, he certainly did a wonderful job.
Well, he saved my life, so what the hell, I know my
business. Right. What was his name again?
I like that.
Dr. Osmond.
You know, he brought some Italian doctors in when I was in. Do me a favor.
Yes.
And Mr. Garrett over his head off right
now.
I
said,
I know Verena and Ferrari.
Wait, put it closer to his head.
And
right here.
We know you did
back.
This thing right.
I'll be damned.
Back. Yeah. Okay, right there. Now take that back.
Your fame will live on.
That. Move it to back towards the door, yeah.
They'll never forget the stingray.
It's the back. It's the we need to flag it up on.
Palm Beach Post?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Is here?
Yeah.
Okay.
keep trying. It's a story they shouldn't miss.
Some of the drawings, I know they can take that. So
6'4" that had the design of General Motors. So I sent out some drawings that they said, you know, do with this car sketch. Show us how you'd like to design a car. So I made some designs in the summer of 35. Howard O'Leary, who was Earl's sort of right-hand man, business manager, wrote me and said, how much would I want? And I asked for more than I think. Maybe I should have got it. One of the sales managers at Rogers told me, he said, if you don't think something of yourself, nobody else would want to forget it. And anyway, I took that summer off and made sketches. And in the winter of 1935, I went to work for, December 15th, 1935, I went to work for General Motors Factory.
You know, I'm going to stop you because I think that part of what you just said there is your own self phone ringing. So it's you.
He wasn't a circle.
Oh, that's a nice phone.
I like the sound. Yeah.
But, maybe if you just back up a tiny bit and and tell us that you just started when you actually started with GE.
Well, I sent these drawings to O'Leary, and he wrote back that I was going to get married at the time. And I'll never forget, I got married and went to Detroit about the same time. And I said to my wife, to unpack because there's some good guys there. Exner was one of them. And I thought, boy, I'll have to go Paul Meyer, some good designers. And I said, I better not unpack. I don't think I'll make it. But I did. And in 1 year, they had me in competition with Frank Hershey on a Buick. Catwalk cooler, and I beat Frank out, and I wanted a Buick studio, but Earl gave me the Cadillac studio, and I didn't think that was much, because Cadillac was no ladies coming, but it was the one best break I probably ever had, because that's the only car Earl ever put any thought to, and he was about to try to keep it in Cadillac and stuff. That's how I got my break. And then in that fall, he put me on the 60 special, Cadillac 60 special. And actually, it was his idea, but I was the leader in the project. And it was the first car without a running board. And it took the belt moments off because the moments were used to cut down the height of the body. It was really much as available today. It was a sports cabin. I was 24 years old. I was chief designer of the cabin.
Would you tell us about Ron Earl?
Well, I thought he was a great guy. You know, I didn't know how to say his name. He always said, Mr. Earl. It was just like one word. And he always dressed very flamboyant. He came from Hollywood. And he had pastel colors. He was always tanned up. And he had perfume on him all the time. And he was quite an enigma. And he was rough on men. If you didn't do what he wanted, he could chew you out. But for some reason, we were on the same wavelength. He never ate me out. He gave me some bad lectures, but he never looked at me. I think we have the same chemistry, whatever you call it. And I have a great admiration for him. I do to this day. We need men like that. Well, your styling is all important. You talk about your engineering, innovations, and all this, but the styling.
May I interject? How was Mr. Earl as a, how would you rate him as a designer, per se, or a design administrator?
Harley Arrow wouldn't draw. He couldn't draw. He didn't draw. But he could visualize stuff. And he could sort of tell you what you didn't know what he was talking about. And when he made the hardtop car, he wanted to make a sedan look like a convertible. But he knew what he wanted, but he didn't draw it. He could say, take this body and take that off and put that on. And he could describe what he wanted. Great believer in change, big change. And of course, Sloan picked him because when they went out to the coast, he found, well, they first did the custom body shows.
We have to stop for a second in the air conditioning room. Is that the air conditioning room?
I know, I missed that. Thank you, sir.
Stop. Air conditioning is going back on again, I think, so they'll make a noise.
Continuity.
Ask Harvey Earl.
Huh?
Ask about Harvey Earl again. Or the last question you just
asked. Oh, yes, of course.
I was real close when I came out, and that's when I noticed the
morning. Fine.
Just turn it off a little while. When it gets too warm, we'll just stop and put it back on for a few minutes. If you want to stop for any reason, I'm going to stop.
Rich wants that question about how your designer asked you again.
I think that was
Mitchell, could we ask you about Harley Earl as a designer? Could you describe his talent and experience as a designer?
Well, being 6'4", and I talked about volcanic gutter, pretty powerful. And I remember the Fisher brothers, they called them Seven Dwarfs, because he'd take them off, he'd tell them off, tell them what he wanted to do. I think he came out there without, took over his style. They call it the art and color section. And he had no, I think Ralph Pugh, he got him from Cadillac. So he was first brought out by Sloan, Fisher Brothers, on a consultant trip. What a good job he did. He said, my God, he's doing so good on the Cadillac. Why can't we get him to do all the general motorcycles? That's what he went and thought, you know, against Fisher Body. And being a big man, I don't think he, Donner never agreed with him, but I think his physical image had a lot to do with it. And when he talked, boy, everybody listened. Harley Earl spoke, he had a director's chair like they had out in Hollywood. He put that down and sit down and got his together around him and he said what he wanted to do and everybody worked for him.
I read something that you said, you were quoting Harley Earl, and you said that Harley Earl said, they don't whistle when you drive past the schoolyard. You should take
right.
it back to the drawing board. Would you tell us that story?
Yeah, he used to say, if you don't have a good-looking car, he said, if you drive by a schoolyard and the kids don't whistle, you better go back to the drawing board.
Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. No, you've got to have in a car, it's got to be, somebody said, gee, look at that. Today, they're boxes that they all look, almost all of them look alike, and there's no identity. You take, for instance, I said at one time I thought the Pontiac ought to change their name. It was a dumb car and didn't have any identity. And I remember at the Pierre Marquette Rod and Gun Club I belonged to, and I went up there and I got in an argument one night with
numbers who was on the man that shot an Adams team. And I said, what changed the name? And he said, if the car is any good, the name will be good. He said, take Duesenberg, Doozy. Hell, that sounds like saucy, but it's so great that the word got around, if anything's good, it was a doozy. He said, if that Pontiac ever got to be good, then the name would be good. And I always remember when Bunky Newton took over the Pontiac. And well, Curtis went to Earl and he said, there was a guy named Klinger who was running the Pontiac, who was more or less a stuffed shirt. And the Pontiac was not a sexy car. And Curtis said, we've got to have somebody run the Pontiac who's got some zip. Earl was very close to old man Newton, and of course he helped bring up Bunky. And so he knew where Bunky was. I think he was with some company. Anyway, he got him transferred to Pontiac. And Bunky said to me, only get those suspenders off the hood. Silver Streaks, that one goes to him. And he said, forget that's what made it, the talk of safety. He said, the hell with safety. Let's get a whole bunch of big instruments on the board, power to show power. And then he went down to Daytona and got Bill France, he got into racing, Firebird Roberts, drove his Pontiac. And boy, you'd see on television, you'd see those Pontiacs winning all the races. In 1 year, he passed Oldsmobile and Buick, and that was an answer. It takes a person to do it.
Would you tell us about your taking over from Harley Earl at GM, and also it'd be interesting to hear a little bit about what GM's attitude toward design was at the time that you took over. The emphasis was on individual designers or group efforts of designers, that sort of thing.
Well, I had an idea, instead of having one studio with 10 designers, I'd rather have 10 studios with one designer each, where you could find out, if you get too many designers in a room, you never know who did the job. And so we concentrated on separate, and then Earl never had a special advanced studio, and I fought for that, and I got studios built down below in the basement, and I sold Gordon on the fact that they would be for safety. The hell with safety. I built them for advanced design. And we had an advanced room for each car, and we had the divisions never come down. They weren't allowed to come down to those rooms. The other rooms, they'd be in, the chief engineer, body engineer would be in any time of the day. That was their. They respected me, and they had never come down and asked from that way. We could look at our own stuff and correct our own mistakes in advance. And that helped us. We did a lot of, like, the Eldorado and the Riviera and cars like that were down in the universe.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the 59 Eldorado that's done roughly around the time that you took over. What, would you just tell us a little bit about what you feel about the design of the 59 Eldorado?
Well, I think it had some power. I don't like the car with the stuff that I'll put and some of the stuff we got today. But I think it had power. You're paying that kind of money. Of course, the government got after some miles per gallon of gas, and that Irv had a job to bring the cars out smaller. I think we lost a lot of our power in this car.
We have ready to change. We're just running out of tape here. We're going to take another cassette in.
Harley Earl's favorite drink was what? Martini? What strength?
Well, he liked strong. He liked that one gin. What was that?
Tanqueray.
Yes. He's a connoisseur of London gin, London dry gin, yes, it's gorgeous. What was your favorite?
Oh,
Please.
I was in the 21 Club one night at the bar in Boston. I had a Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy said, do you know how that drink came about? And I said, no. He said, Charles Dan against the illustrator. He's in the Friars Club. And he ordered a martini and they ran out of olives. He said, I can't drink a martini without olives. The guy said, try one with onions.
Pearl onion. Marvelous.
Okay.
Mr. Earl, can you tell us more about the El Dorado? This is a long-running mark in GM history. Can you tell us how it started, Mr. Earl's original intention and design, and how it proliferated?
No, he wanted that little window. Well, then we ate that window, put it in the Pontiac, Chevrolet,
mm-hmm.
Monte Carlo.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, at El Dorado, I got a friend of mine who lives down here from Pennsylvania, from Titusville. I got him one of our designer's cars, and he's kept it.
The El Dorado, of course, went out in a blaze of glory, or almost with a blaze of glory, with fins. Tell us about the fin era at GM and how it came about.
Well, I think what happened there actually got onto the fin.
Virgil Exner Sr.?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We tried out fin. And I think the two worst years at GM, if I can talk about, is 58 and 59. 58, we were putting chrome on with the trowel. We had chrome on everything. 59, we tried out Penn Chrysler, and Exner was put some stuff out. We had all kinds of things. We had the Chevrolet with the spread out wing. Then 61, I calmed them down. I got the things calmed down, made the pins very superior. I remember I got my mother a 59, I wasn't really what year it was, and I went down to Miami to pick it up, and then driving it up to Lauderdale, got the pins, I thought somebody was following me. I hadn't seen it for a while, and I was turning in the back.
Would you tell us what the Bud Harley Earl's inspiration for the 59 El Dorado was? I heard once it had something to do with a certain kind of jet.
38. We went out to Selfridge Field and saw the first D-38, the 13th one I saw. And you could just see from the headlight back through to the tail how you could make that a design. And that was the inspiration, D-38. And when I was in the Navy, our big radio engine didn't have any sex with the fire that the Army pointed out. And they'd come by in a B-38, you could see it in the sky. But those two things, like one of our designers said, old John Lutz, our mom, he said, you see one horse going around the track, you don't know how fast it goes, but when there's two of them going, you can tell the speed. And that's what the 38 had. It had some action in the sky.
The Cadillac 60 Special, we're fascinated by that. One of your earliest and best creations. Can you tell us a bit about how that came about? 1938 Cadillacs,
well,
something special.
Well, it was going to be the LaSalle.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, at that time, the LaSalle Cadillac was practically the same engine. But we wanted to give it a different image. And I can't tell you exactly how that came about, but get it away from the camera, make it a sports car. It really was like the Seville today.
And would you also tell us about how the Riviera came about?
That's really an interesting thing. You know, we had the Corvette and sports car, but then we made one year in Motorama. We made a lot of four-passenger sports cars. Quite a few old Buicks. We noticed that Ford was down there taking dimensions of Waldorf. But we didn't take it seriously until the Thunderbird came. And then everybody was going to Gordon and Crudden.
Yep.
And we, the dealers were saying, we got to have an answer to that.
Excuse me, Mr. Mitchell. You hear that noise? I think they're cutting hedges next door or something. Maybe we should take a little break now until they stop, and we'll ask you to tell that story again when we start up again. Is that the other thing? Should we do that? Cool the room off a little bit, too.
Yeah.
This is
Getting the lights
up? Yes.
Going very well. Just fabulous. How are you feeling? Okay?